But in St. Paul, the baseline by just pure zoning allowance will be 4 units of housing on pretty much every lot, except for one little corner of the far east side that is doesn't have septic tanks. So for practical purposes, at least 4 units on every lot.
I'm here in Minneapolis, though. I didn't understand that modern sewage had come to St. Paul.
This is a real thing. Real thing.
None of you have the balls to stop this. Stop this.
I've got plenty of time. I have nothing else going on today.
We're in the Wedge neighborhood right now. 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 Right now.
Welcome to the Wedge Live Podcast. I'm your host, John Edwards. Today's episode is about zoning, single-family zoning. St. Paul might eliminate single-family zoning this week. I'm not sure if this episode is going to air on the day that it potentially comes up for a vote, Wednesday. And my guest is Zach Udishtu, who is a student at McAllister College in St. Paul, writes for streets.mn. You edit. Editor-in-chief of the student newspaper. Do I have that correct, Zach?
That's right, yes.
Any other biographical points you want to include?
I'll mention you can find some of my writing in other places. Pops up around the Twin Cities. So I have some work published in Southwest Voices that I'm working on right now, the Minnesota Reformer. And then also I serve on the board of Sustain St. Paul. So we do advocacy around urbanism policy in St. Paul.
I forgot to mention that one. You're very prolific, Zach. For a young person, very prolific. You're everywhere.
Well, thank you. There's a lot to write about, so.
And it's your interests match up perfectly with mine. We've never met before, but I'm looking forward to this conversation about St. Paul. They are considering changes that would allow anywhere from 2 to 5 unit homes on formerly single-family lots, eliminate zoning rules that restricted large portions of the city to single-family homes exclusively. People in Minneapolis will be familiar with this because we did a similar thing as part of the 2040 plan. Do I have it correct? What is happening in St. Paul?
Yeah, that's about the right big picture view of it. It is similar to the changes in the Minneapolis 2040 plan in that areas that for a long time have only allowed single-family homes will have more units of housing. The details vary, and in every city that does a change like this, the details always vary. But in St. Paul, the baseline by just pure zoning allowance will be 4 units of housing on pretty much every lot, except for one little corner of the far east side that doesn't have septic tanks. So for practical purposes, at least 4 units on every lot. And
I'm sorry. I'm just like, I thought most places in St. Paul didn't have septic tanks. I'm here in Minneapolis, though. I didn't understand that modern sewage had come to St. Paul.
Yeah, if you come take a walk through the neighborhood, I can show you how our modern infrastructure works in St. Paul, believe it or not. But then there will also be 5 units on some of the lots that have previously had a little bit looser version of single family zoning, and then also certain what they call neighborhood nodes. So it's a lot of your busier intersections, places along bus rapid transit and the light rail. Those are going to have 5 units as the baseline. And then all those places get a whole nother unit if they meet certain standards for affordability or if they preserve the existing building. You could have potentially 6 units on lots that are currently only allowing single family. And then one other thing that I like to emphasize is relative to the 2040 plan's changes, there's a lot of other elements of specific details around built form and the size of housing, the square footage, the height, that are a little bit looser than the 2040 plan's duplex and triplex zones are.
Okay, I want to get into that later because I'm very interested in that topic as well. So it's widely understood, I think, at this point, what are we, 5 years on from when Minneapolis talked about the 2040 plan, that eliminating single-family zoning in Minneapolis in favor of triplex zoning, that's what we did here, had very little impact in terms of housing production. I think it's like 50, 60 units a year in those categories, one to two, three, maybe even including four unit buildings. So you can technically allow more units in your zoning code, but if other rules constraining the physical size are left in place, adding units is still impractical. And I saw council member Naker from St. Paul on TV recently using similar talking points that you would hear 5 years ago in Minneapolis around the 2040 plan and single family zoning, that basically the building sizes are all going to be the same, nothing to worry about. We're just adding more units inside the building. So all you people who care about neighborhood character, don't worry. Nothing will change on the outside. It's just about what goes on in the inside. Is that true? Tell me why this could work out differently in St. Paul.
And I would certainly still say that this isn't going to radically change the neighborhood character or like the look and feel of a lot of the residential neighborhoods of St. Paul. But it is true that around some of the, you know, there's a lot of different zoning regulations that are not just the number of units you can have on a lot that regulate the size and appearance of housing. And in St. Paul, you have a few things that are a bit laxer. So there's going to be a couple different residential districts now, and they're going to have building heights that are more like 35 feet at the high end. So you're probably not going to see four-story buildings, but that's, I believe, a little higher than Minneapolis has in their lowest density residential neighborhoods. One change that I think is significant is the lot sizes. So in Minneapolis, in residential neighborhoods, you still can't split a 5,000 square foot kind of typical size city lot. You're not going to be able to just split it down the middle and put two skinny homes on it, or split it even with the street and have a second home in the back that you sell. St. Paul is setting up some rules that you could actually split a typical city lot as small as maybe 2,500 feet, potentially even smaller, and sell those two lots with separate buildings on them. So on those kinds of elements, St. Paul's is going to be a little different. And then one thing that you've probably heard about in Minneapolis is a lot of people go to the floor area ratio, which is the rule of how much square footage of building you can have relative to the total square footage of the lot. And in Minneapolis, all the residential zones still have a 0.5 floor area ratio, which means if you have a typical 5,000 square foot lot and you want to build a triplex, you're looking at barely 800 foot units, and it's a little bit of a tough sell and just tough building economics to make that work given the price point you'd be able to sell that at. And so it's not so surprising that very few people have built triplexes in Minneapolis given those constraints. St. Paul, as far as I can tell, they're not directly regulating floor area ratio in the same way. They have other regulations that make sure you're not going to have a huge building. But in general, all of these little elements are a bit looser in St. Paul, and I think you're still not going to see a massive flood of fourplexes or triplexes, but it is going to be a little easier to build them.
So another thing that I think in hindsight maybe people knew going into it that was going to have a bigger impact with the 2040 plan was straightening out our zoning code in other areas like transit corridors, because the units really start to add up. If you want to produce more housing someplace, the units really add up when it comes to those big buildings on transit corridors, 50, 100 units or more. And that's where we've seen real housing growth in Minneapolis. Just give us the lay of the land in St. Paul. How is St. Paul doing on that measure?
Yeah, so as far as these specific zoning changes go, it's pretty much entirely out of the scope of what St. Paul is considering, what they've been working on for the past couple of years. They're not going to change anything with how those larger multifamily buildings are getting developed. In St. Paul in general, you can kind of tell there's been some stalling. There's, of course, a ton of discussion on how much that is owed to rent control, how much it is owed to other market conditions that are also making building challenging. But you see them popping up. It's not like St. Paul is a consistently impossible place to build larger housing. I would definitely say you're not seeing as much of the big multifamily housing as Minneapolis.
So if you looked at Minneapolis's pre-2040 rezoning code, it's probably a lot like other places, maybe worse. I don't know. I haven't studied a ton of other city zoning codes, but it's very patchy. It's like, why is this blob of very low density zoning or very high density zoning in this location? There seems to be no rhyme or reason for why one part of the city is zoned higher or lower density, regardless of how close it is to transit or downtown or other amenities. And if you look at the map now, it's very orderly, and you can kind of figure out, like, well, these places closer to transit or closer to downtown have higher zoning, and decisions have been made without regard to, like, wealth or status or how politically powerful a certain part of the city is to get these special considerations in zoning code. I see that as a really big benefit of the plan, in addition to, like, a lot of the upzoning along transit corridors. Like, the zoning code is starting to make sense. And I don't know if you're prepared to answer this question, but do you feel like there is similar room for improvement in St. Paul? And I know this is outside the scope of what they're doing right now, but, like, generally and broadly, what do you think?
Yeah, I think something that's really important is process and ease through which you can get through these kinds of, like, housing projects. And I actually had a great conversation for a story I'm working on with Jason Wittenberg, who works for the Minneapolis Planning Department. And one thing he pointed me to that he sees a real success in Minneapolis is they spend a much lower amount of their time at the City Planning Commission doing variance approvals for developments. And so a variance was often happening because the height limits were not really well defined, or they weren't working well in multifamily districts of Minneapolis. So then developer has to go through this whole process. They don't know if they're going to get approved or not. It's a lot of cost, it's uncertainty, it's time. All those kinds of things also make it a lot easier to build. And it having less variances is in part downstream of what you just described, having a cleaner, kind of more legible zoning code. There's definitely room for that. And one thing I would say is, as much as you can have clear rules on the front end, you know, it's still democratic in that we come together as a city and policymakers decide what the rules are. But then if you have those rules clearly established, you don't need to have a single project getting approved every time because you've clarified the rules at the beginning. And I think that's a place where St. Paul could definitely improve.
So it's important to emphasize for people who don't pay attention to politics, this is happening in election year. This very, what you would think would be a very controversial thing based on the politics of 2018 and when Minneapolis did the 2040 plan. We had yard signs. We had a yard sign campaign in a non-election year, a year after the city council had and mayor had been elected. So we're 3 years away from any city election, and people have yard signs protesting the elimination of single-family zoning, claiming that entire neighborhoods would be bulldozed. And this is happening election year in St. Paul. Some would say that's very courageous of these council members to take this up and the city to take this up. I'm not following St. Paul politics. How many incumbents are on the ballot, first of all? And do you have any response for how the politics are going and why this is coming up in an election year?
If I have this right, there's maybe three incumbents on the ballot, but I would
need seven.
Yeah, out of seven.
Okay, maybe that explains it.
But what's interesting is I've looked through, so like MinPost has a great candidate questionnaire, and I've looked through, and there's a lot, I would say a lot of people who seem to be front runners or leaders in within their ward are supporting this. It's not just the incumbents, and it's not just the new potential council members who are in favor of this change. And the politics just seems so different than when the Minneapolis 2040 plan passed. I think in large part it's owed to Minneapolis themselves being the leaders, and they were kind of the ones who took a leap into the dark on this, and really major cities hadn't done a change like this at that point. And now it seems to be happening every month in a city or even a state. Even in Montana this last spring, for example, legalized duplexes everywhere, a lot of ADU reform across the whole state. And so Minneapolis really led, and then I think a lot of other localities have been there's more consensus emerging on the value of zoning reform and like why we need to move beyond this barrier to housing. So that's a big part of it. And so we thank the Minneapolis people for that for sure, because they really kind of endured really nasty politics around this issue to let us skate through relatively easily, it seems. Well, the city council hasn't voted yet, but I feel fairly optimistic about it. And then another big change related to that is there's no organized opposition. There is not a group of people in St. Paul who have like spent coordinated effort to block the zoning changes or to protest them. There's maybe a couple flyers that have gone around the Facebook pages, but when you look at who testified this last Wednesday and who's been writing public comments, it's overwhelmingly in favor of the zoning changes. So not having an opposition group really makes all the difference. And it's not
That's
like
bizarre.
It's not like there's that NIMBYism in St. Paul.
Right.
We're in the midst of this just exhausting fight over the Summit Avenue bike lane,
which feels like it's not going to happen anytime soon. Isn't that like 10 years off? There's like no time frame for that to be built.
Years before they don't even have the funding set aside for it yet. There's no like concrete project that's about to happen, and yet it's this huge drawn out battle where the Save Our Streets people who are opposed to the Summit bike lanes are pretty well coordinated at every point in the process. They have been lobbying the Parks and Rec at the city back when that was when they were the relevant body, then the city council, and now the Met Council at a couple different bodies within the Met Council. So it's not like there aren't people in St. Paul who are really opposed to seeing change, who you would think would be opposed to zoning changes that allow for more housing in exactly the way of the Minneapolis people who were opposed to legalizing triplexes citywide. But they're just, for whatever reason, not really keyed into this change.
They're checked out. They're distracted somehow. You've abducted them. You're hiding them in a basement somewhere.
No comment on that. It does feel like there's a bit of a lesson learned from Minneapolis having not a ton of development. There definitely wasn't a ton of bulldozers coming for your single-family homes. And so that could be a reason, too. People kind of realize this is actually not totally transformative.
And yet we're still we're 5 years into this 10-year plan. We're still dealing with this lawsuit. Like, how stupid is that?
Yeah.
The thing that they're suing over has not produced the thing they predicted, because we're 5 years in. You think it would have happened by now if it was going to happen.
Right.
And yet it's full steam ahead on this very expensive lawsuit for both sides. It blows my mind how much money and time and resources have been wasted on this lawsuit in St. Paul. St. Paul's just like zooming right through, going to do it without any fanfare. We really did take all the bullets for St. Paul.
You did. We walked so we could run.
And it's not like there aren't terrible people in St. Paul. I know they exist. It come out terrible people in St. Paul. Don't make it seem like Minneapolis has a monopoly on that.
Well, I almost wonder with regards to the lawsuit, it kind of goes to show that a few people who are well-resourced can muck everything up, and the absence of those few people can make everybody's life really nice.
Yeah. One of the things that was remarkable, I thought when the 2040 plan passed, just having a 50-50 balance, it felt like, at public hearings was a huge difference to the way these things traditionally go, at least in my experience, which is like the 2010s of going to a lot of zoning meetings. Usually it's the people who are against who are very motivated to show up. The people who are like kind of apathetic or like soft supporters of things, who don't necessarily have a personal stake, but like philosophically agree with the idea. Yeah, cities change and people need places to live, and not allowing more housing will make the city really unaffordable. That's a bad idea. They just kind of like don't show up because they're not as motivated. The personal stake isn't there. So what was the proportion of support to opposition at this public hearing recently?
So at the city council hearing this last Wednesday, it was two people against and I believe 20 in favor.
That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. So it felt easy. And then a lot of positive response from the city council at the end of the hearing, not unanimously so, but pretty strongly positive.
One of my theories is local news and social media kind of got tired of the topic. Like, predicting bulldozers as a phenomenon, it just gets old. Like, it stops scaring people as much if you're constantly saying it and it doesn't happen. And so, like, the fear factor kind of wore off.
I think so. I mean, you can only exaggerate the truth for so long. Eventually, you can see that it's not going to lead to a bunch of destruction of existing housing.
So, staying on the politics, what do we think is, what's motivating this change? Who are the heroes? Who are the players? Are there particular elected officials or, like, people within St. Paul City Hall pushing this, activists, groups like Sustain St. Paul? Like, what's motivating this change? Do we give all the credit to people in Minneapolis like me, the real heroes? Like, who do we give credit to?
Well, I think some of the real heroes of it are two people in the city staff who have been working on this, or maybe three, but and like I've seen a lot of public engagement with a couple in particular city staff that I want to shout out, Emma Brown and Tony Johnson, I believe. And they work in the planning department of St. Paul, and they've really done a lot of the groundwork for all of these changes. So they're the ones who have done analysis of the existing zoning code. What are some of the things that are barriers? They have looked at what are other cities doing. So they said, looked at what we could learn from Minneapolis, but also they looked to Portland, Oregon, which did kind of similar changes. They've prepared a lot of documents and memos and slides, some stuff that I think especially commendable for just being great accessible visualizations of what these changes could look like. And so that the having, you know, officials from the city consistently put that kind of stuff out, I think makes a huge difference for how council members might perceive it. And so I think a lot of credit goes to them. I think Sustain St. Paul, I'd like to take a little credit for just what I think what we've been able to do is make sure there's always people testifying and keep some of our friends looped in, you know, like the other friends who have been an important part of this coalition include like the Sierra Club is really great on this kind of change because they can see the connection between density and lower carbon emissions. And then other people, I think what's interesting is there's a kind of a good consensus among some of the affordable housing groups, the people who advocate for funding for affordable housing, who work on that subsidized part of the housing market, also see how this isn't, you know, this isn't going to give them more subsidy or anything, but it is complementary to their goals. So those people have sent in letters. And then with regards to elected officials, I mean, what's interesting is it's not a huge topic. So nobody's having to make a huge stand for it, but I know that the city, like the mayor and his administration are on board, and this is happening under their administration. It's the city that's doing the study. I think Mitra is a great supporter of these kinds of changes. There was great quote from Nelsie Yang at the city council meeting, Amy Brenmoen. Really, I would say almost all of the city council members, though, are quite positive.
It's remarkable. One thing I'll say is that the power of showing up to these things, like the power you have just by showing up, because so few people do show up. I think the total people you mentioned you showed up was about 20 at that public hearing. Am I right?
Yeah.
And so if you could be one of those 20 people, having your voice heard in front of a city council anywhere in any city, that is very powerful. They assume if you showed up, there must be some X number of people who didn't show up who agree with you. So just show up to things is my advice to people. If the things you care about in this world, especially where local government can have an impact, show up and contact your council member, because so few people even know it's happening. There's a lot of power in that.
I totally agree.
I saw the thing you wrote at Streets MN about changes that Sustain St. Paul would like to see. And I don't know how relevant this is to our conversation, but the idea of shifting, was it about a bonus unit, the transit thing, changing from 1/8 of a mile to a 1/4 mile? Is that the difference that would make?
This is a kind of a small thing, but we could look and see that there's overall good support. So we're like, let's just make these changes a little bolder. Let's go a little further. And so I mentioned earlier, there's a difference between, there's two zones they're going to have in existing single family areas. One is going to have a baseline of 4 units. One is going to have a baseline of 5 units. And the 5 unit one is also going to have a little more flexibility around all the other things like height and width and setbacks and so forth. And part of the area that would receive that 5 unit zoning, which is called H2, was going to be anywhere around an eighth mile of neighborhood nodes, which is a, just a city designation for, again, key intersections and also transit stops are included in these neighborhood nodes. And so we were kind of thinking, like, what's one thing that we can push for that we just want to pick, as given that we think we can go a little further, this seems like a great place to go. And so we expanded it. We were hoping that the city council will elect to expand that 5 unit zoning designation to a quarter mile around neighborhood nodes, which is pretty close. I mean, a quarter mile is...
Two blocks. It's like 2 blocks, right?
Yeah. It's something you would absolutely do to walk to your transit stop. And so we're hoping it'll just go a little further. And again, it's a marginal change, but we'll take every marginal positive change we can get.
It's so much common sense. I think people who maybe don't take transit or aren't familiar with like how far things are, like transit riders are walking many more blocks than two. Anyone who takes the bus regularly or makes connections, like the walking that is involved with taking transit is incredible. And 2 blocks is nothing.
Yes. So. Yes. So we're hoping we'll see you on Wednesday what the city council members decide to do.
Here's another argument I'm going to quote from. I don't know if this is you talking or Sustain St. Paul. I'm going to quote it. St. Paul is struggling to maintain our streets, to fully fund our libraries, schools, parks, and rec centers. At the same time, residential homeowners are struggling to afford annual increases to property taxes, end quote. And like downtowns are hollowing out across the country. Cities are struggling with tax base. It feels like a no-brainer to add more housing, make it affordable to live in cities near all these amenities, for people to live sustainably, have a high quality of life, be happy. I don't know what my question is there. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Not everybody is kind of an urbanist nerd who enjoys looking at old triplexes or fourplexes that got built in the Twin Cities before we made the zoning code more restrictive. So it's good to point out there's a lot of reasons that you could support these changes. And one of them is the property tax base. And if you, a typical fourplex is definitely going to be, like, if you redeveloped this older single-family home today into a fourplex, the overall value of that plot is going to be higher than a single-family home. But it's fairly likely that the per-unit cost of living in those plex units is going to be lower. So it's a total win-win.
Going back to the affordable housing developers piece you were talking about, so Minneapolis Public Housing Authority built... You're probably familiar with this, like 80-some units. I think they refer to it as scattered site. Like, I think formerly single-family home sites that they owned, they're building, like, I don't know what the unit mix is, but like 4 to 6 unit buildings in that range on these parcels that they would not have been able to do before. That's a big win.
So I have an article coming out maybe in the next week-ish for Southwest Voices about the 2040 plan. And I actually had a conversation with a staff member at the Minneapolis Public Housing Agency about exactly that. And they have, we focused, just because it's a geographic focus of the of Southwest Voices, we talked about a sixplex they're building on Penn Avenue. And they said, and what's interesting is Penn Avenue is surrounded by that triplex zoning, but because it's a little bit busier of a street, it gets 6 units max, and it gets a little more flexibility around floor area ratio. And they're redeveloping a single home into 6 units, and that's a substantial difference. It enables the Public Housing Authority to house more families that they wouldn't have been able to before, and particularly for a public agency for whom it's very expensive to buy city land. They get to take the land that they already own and build more public housing for families, which is great.
I often forget that St. Paul ended parking minimums along with Minneapolis. As I was reading some of the stuff you've written recently, that came up. It's like, I forget so much that St. Paul has done. I'm sorry for forgetting you, St. Paul. They also ended parking minimums. That's a big deal. Another thing that makes it more possible to develop these smaller scale housing types is not having to deal with parking minimums. You can't do like a 10-unit building, even if it's zoned for it, makes it very hard to do that if you've got parking requirements to deal with.
Yeah, it's a huge deal. And it's another case where St. Paul is maybe a little more sneaky. It's a significant change that I think for Minneapolis, it didn't seem to be a huge controversy either. But St. Paul, it was like a whisper. You wouldn't have heard a lot about St. Paul ending parking minimums. But it's just a thing that subtly makes all the housing development a little more easy and a little more beneficial in other ways. So there's a great example of my neighborhood council last week or a couple weeks ago, McAllister Groveland. There was a developer coming to just show us what he was planning to build on Grand Avenue. He's going to do 12 units with 3 parking spots. He said if parking minimums had still been in place, he would have built less units and more parking, which is kind of two worse things. So it just makes all the difference. I mean, it's going to be almost impossible to build a fourplex in a residential neighborhood if you had to build 4 parking spots.
One thing I'm noticing, speaking of politics and how angry people get at public meetings, transportation politics, at least in Minneapolis, just seems, and it's probably true in St. Paul because they're dealing with the Summit Avenue thing. Like, people are really up in arms when it comes to transportation. Minneapolis has the Transportation Action Plan, which I'm a big fan of. It kind of flows from the goals outlined in the 2040 plan. It's kind of like an offspring document of the 2040 plan, which I think is great. How is St. Paul doing on transportation, do you think?
Yeah, I'd say I'm a little less in the weeds than that, but they have a pretty solid bike plan they've just been releasing this great plan and kind of sharing that and getting feedback on that in the last 9 months or so. And they're making an effort. And I think it's a testament to St. Paul that despite all the organized opposition to the Summit bike path, the city council still voted for it 6-1. The city staffers are still totally bought in and trying to push it through, the transportation planners. And I think that's a good example. Like, people in St. Paul really are making an effort. And even though there are some actors in the politics who are kind of nasty, St. Paul is making progress.
What do you think the effect of rent control has been in St. Paul? It's a big issue. It's an election year in both St. Paul and Minneapolis. And all the candidate forums in Minneapolis, it's getting asked about. One of the stock answers from opponents of any kind of rent stabilization or rent control policy is that we know it failed in St. Paul. It went too far. Development was hindered by it. I wonder if you have any opinions as somebody who follows St. Paul closer than I do.
I mean, it seems pretty clear that there was a decrease in housing construction in St. Paul after the rent control was passed. And anecdotally, you hear a lot from developers saying, this makes me not want to build in St. Paul. Now, you really can't give so much weight to the kind of firsthand things that developers say. And they, of course, have their own political interests. But it seems likely to me that there was a negative effect. And what's tricky is it's just a trade-off. And a good rent control policy can be enormously beneficial for tenants. And I think it's important to have that. But you don't like St. Paul did do a lot of stricter elements in their rent control policy than most cities do. And it's really hard to have certainty. I wish there was better research about it or better data about it, but I think it was probably the right decision to pull back on some of the things, in particular to give an exemption for new housing, because I think it looks really different to rent control a building 20 years down the line after building it than immediately. But there needs to be a lot more research and a lot more evaluation. I don't think St. Paul should now fully eliminate their policy, although I don't think that will be on the table unless something crazy happens in the city council elections. And I think Minneapolis should continue trying to work towards something, but they should be cognizant of the trade-offs. And I think it doesn't help anybody if you approach it as if there was no trade-off. And so you have to be really careful about it, and you have to be thoughtful about it. Ultimately, it's hard to say what exactly the right decision is. So there's my wishy-washy answer for you.
I mean, you're basically giving my opinion. The frustration I have with the discussion in Minneapolis is that one side wants a very strong St. Paul style version. The other side says there should be nothing, and that any painting a picture that says all rent stabilization policies are the same, which we know from there are many jurisdictions that have it, and they're like all different, all varying degrees of restrictions. And I think about it like the minimum wage. Like, can we just agree on the concept that some kind of limit is appropriate, and then debate what the limit and details of the policy should be? Like, we don't even do that. And it's frustrating.
I agree.
So we're at the very end. Do you have any recommendations, Zach? I typically do this at the end, and I let the guest give a recommendation for anything they're enjoying now. It could be a hobby, a TV show, something you like. It could be a place you enjoy walking. What can you recommend to people to do?
I'll give a St. Paul recommendation. It really is worth it to come over here every now and then if you live in Minneapolis. St. Paul Brewing, which you really just miss the golden time in summer because they have an outstanding patio, but it is a refurbished segment of the Hams Brewery, which they had a huge brewery just to the east of downtown St. Paul. And now there's this small brewer, St. Paul Brewing, that refurbished a little bit, and they have their own brewing set up, and they have food there, and they have tasty beer, and a truly beautiful patio with nice lights and all kinds of funky furniture. So I think that is a must-see place if you don't know St. Paul that well.
Okay, thank you for that recommendation. My guest has been Zach Udishtu. This has been the Wedge Life Podcast. I'm your host, John Edwards. Thank you for listening.
This is a real thing. None of you have the balls to stop this.
Going on today.
We're in the Wedge neighborhood right now. 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 Right now.